Flight of the Diamond Smugglers. Blinding elements of reportage, memoir and incantation, Flight of the Diamond Smugglers takes a rare and remarkable portrait of exploitation and greed in the world's most dangerous areas of coastal South Africa. Here to tell us more about it is the author of Flight of the Diamond Smugglers, Matthew Frank. Good morning to you, Matthew.
Good morning, Giles. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. Tell us a little bit about then where we are, what part of the world we're in, and what we're actually looking at.
So we are on the northwest portion of South Africa, close to the border with Namibia. It is a region known colloquially as the Diamond Coast, due to the fact that the diamond conglomerates, such as De Beers, Transhex, Alex Corr, still control much of the underground mineral rights of the area. And many of the towns in the area are basically corporate towns, folks who are laboring as miners for these huge diamond conglomerates.
And this is also known as, is it the Forbidden Zone? Is that the whole coast, or is that a particular section of it?
So, yeah, that the Forbidden Zone is kind of like the extreme northwest portion of South Africa into the extreme southwest portion of Namibia. And so it was known as the Forbidden Zone due to the fact that for the better part of 80 years, this region was closed off to the public. It was essentially terra incognita meets planned community. So unless you labored directly for the diamond conglomerates, you could not enter. De Beers, even for a spell, had a shadowy agreement with the satellite companies that flew over the earth capturing satellite images to redact images of the Forbidden Zone or the Diamond Coast from basically their pictures of the earth. So officially, it did not exist.
So how does it, if it doesn't exist and it's been off limits to the public for, blimey, what is it, sort of 80 years or so, how did you hear about it and how did you try and gain access?
Yeah, so beginning in 2007, De Beers and a couple of the other diamond conglomerates in the area deemed the area to be overmined. And so they started withdrawing some of their interest there. And because they withdrew some of their interest there, the doors to some of these previously closed off towns, again, towns that were closed off to the public for the better part of 80 years, these doors were thrown open to the public for the first time. And I had heard about this because I am innately attracted to forbidden spaces. In fact, 10 out of my 12 juvenile arrests were for trespassing. And so I had heard about the Forbidden Zone. And when I learned that I could navigate a certain series of channels, I had to go through multiple background checks, send in multiple copies of my passport. And eventually they allowed me onto the property. I drove there. There was a heavily armed security guard in a security tower who descended with a gun about as tall as I am and made me fill out a bunch of paperwork there on the ground, then lifted up the boom gate and allowed me in to talk to people.
It's if my geography serves me correctly, and it's a bit rusty, so please bear with me, Matthew. Isn't this? I mean, if you're in northern sort of South Africa, you're almost on the Namibia, aren't you? On the Skeleton Coast, so it's a particularly inhospitable part of the world.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. It's pretty inhospitable, both landscape wise. It's pretty barren desert, it's also somewhat socially inhospitable. Because it has the area has been environmentally ravaged by the diamond conglomerates, the populace has kind of been indentured to the diktats of corporate colonialism.
So, did you make contact with anybody before that, or did you just sort of wander in as a, if you like, an American investigative reporter? And if you are, you know, what were you expecting to find, and what did you find? I mean, the book mentions it's like an eerie ghost town.
Yeah. So when I first went there, I actually made three visits to the area from 2013 to 2016. And when I first went there, it was simply to satisfy some sort of innate curiosity that I had about the area. I had no idea that I was going to get a book out of this. But once in the Forbidden Zone, I found that people were very eager to talk to me. So when, you know, you are from a town that has been kept in, you know, kind of this corporate induced isolation for nearly a century, transgenerationally, you know, outsiders vividly stand out. And so I vividly stood out, and folks kind of came up to me and just started asking me what I was doing there. And then they started unburdening to me, telling me their stories. I found that they were very eager to talk to me. And I eventually began talking to folks who labored for De Beers as diamond miners. And late one night in a bar called Diamond Hunters, a former diamond diver actually started talking to me about the ancillary industry of diamond smuggling and the various ingenious methods employed by smugglers to spirit diamonds out of the mines in order to reclaim a little bit of agency over their land and to make a little bit of extra money.
I'm really impressed by the story. I'm really amazed that, you know, something like De Beers would, once they left, didn't sort of have you, I don't know, if didn't have you tailed or taken away, or and that people were quite willing to talk to you about this.
It's funny. The area and the De Beers, I mean, the De Beers officials to whom I spoke were very swaggery with the sort of impunity that the corporation supplied them with. So they were very much willing to talk to me about the corporate trespass on the area, because they were kind of above punishment. You know, a lot of this, you know, a lot of the trespasses that De Beers made on the land is common knowledge. And De Beers kind of still can operate with a bit of impunity. And so folks weren't worried about talking to a guy like me.
You meet a young diamond smuggler, and my pronunciation probably wrong. Is it MCZ? Is that correct?
That's right, MCZ.
And he had an ingenious way, but most of the diamond smugglers did, which involves carrier pigeons. And this is already a fantastical story, but this is even a more fantastical element to the story.
Yeah. So Mzizi was a 13-year-old diamond miner, and he had a trained carrier pigeon named Bartholomew, and he would employ the practice that was not uncommon in the area of sneaking his trained carrier pigeon, Bartholomew, onto mine property, oftentimes concealed in a lunchbox, and mid-shift, attaching rough diamonds he would cinch them up in little bags and attach the bags, one to each of the bird's feet, one beneath each of the bird's wings. And then he would set Bartholomew into the air to fly back home, where Mzizi's mother would untie the diamonds and sell them on the black market.
And presumably this is something that is his... I was going to say frowned upon, but that's not a strong enough word, is it? I mean, presumably, if you are caught with a carrier pigeon, you are in big trouble. Or if you know, guards or whatever see a carrier pigeon, presumably that's they will shoot it down.
Yeah, so these people are putting themselves at great risk in order to do this, of course. And De Beers actually had it declared illegal to raise carrier pigeons in the region. So carrier pigeons were banned. So people still, once again, at like great personal peril, raised these pigeons in secret. In fact, in 1998, in Alexander Bay, South Africa, on the extreme northwest corner of the country, on the border with Namibia, a local lawmaker basically made it illegal to not shoot a pigeon on sight should one have the means to do so. So, for instance, if you're walking along the streets of Alexander Bay and a pigeon crosses your path and you happen to have a gun strapped to your hip and you do not shoot that pigeon and try and kill that pigeon, and a De Beers security official sees you not kill that pigeon, you can be fined, or worse.
There is, and it's got all the makings of a Hollywood movie. There's a figure who appears almost mythical, that seems to embody sort of the evil, if you like, of the big business. This is Mr. Lester. Now, is it a real figure, or is he a sort of myth, a conglomeration of all the corporates and all the security?
Well, this is a bit of a spoiler, I suppose, but Mr. Lester is, I would say, both. Mr. Lester is an actual figure, a person who's very, very high up in De Beers. He was kind of the head of security for a while, but then he also had numerous other titles, including mitigator. And he did a lot of kind of secret work for De Beers. I was actually able to find him and speak with him. And that comes later on in the book. But until then, I believed, and I think a lot of other folks who labored for De Beers kind of like a little bit further down on the ladder, believed that he was a myth, that he was a tall tale, kind of this built up sort of mythological villain meant to keep a lot of the diamond miners in line. So legend had it, until I actually found him and, you know, found that he was actually a human being, legend had it that he was 30 feet tall, that he breathed fire, that he had the ability to infiltrate people's dreams, and all of this. So the townsfolk spun a lot of legends around Mr. Lester, but he was very much real.
You talk about these, 30 feet tall, breathing fire, infiltrating people's dreams—that sort of folkloric aspect. But in the book, it is a straight reportage story as well. But they also managed to weave the mystical, because I suppose in a place as barren and foreboding and as elemental as the Diamond Coast, you do feel that, if you like, the presence of the other.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the landscape itself felt very much like an overcooked, frazzled dreamscape. There was a surreality to it. And myth-making and legend-making kind of loomed large as part of the cultural fabric of the populace there, in order to perhaps make easier sense of their transgenerational predicament of being indentured to a corporation like De Beers or Transhex or Alex Corps. And in speaking with people, I became very interested in this compulsion to make myth out of the actual. And in writing the book, I became very interested in the ways in which we've engaged pigeons in some of our favorite myths, how pigeons appear in human legend and myth making, and how diamonds also appear in our stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And where in those stories do the myths of pigeons and the myths of diamonds intersect? And what could that tell us? And how could that, in part, however inadequately, contextualize some of the intense stuff that I was seeing there on the ground?
And as well as that, it's a bit of a personal memoir as well, because you kind of look in when you're in that bleak landscape. You're reflecting on yourself, which must have been a hard thing to write.
Yeah. So at the time, I was enduring. And I'm not going to get into this too much, but I was enduring just some personal grief. My wife and I had gone through a bit of a tragedy, and I found myself on the Diamond Coast in the aftermath of that tragedy. And I found that my interaction with the stories that I was encountering there on the Diamond Coast and with some of the people I met there on the Diamond Coast were allowing my own personal endurance of grief to evolve and morph in unpredictable ways. And so that did worm its way into the book, yeah.
I mean, the whole book is quite extraordinary, but I mean, you're exploring these myths, these incantations, the place of diamonds and winged birds. You can go back to doves as well if you want to, and pigeons as well. But also, the story as a piece of reporting stands on its own. I mean, you know, mythical figures, you know, 30-foot tall evil figures, and not only that, but vigilante pigeon, almost like bounty hunters for pigeons.
That's right. So, though not officially sanctioned by De Beers, yeah, these anti-pigeon militias persist in the area, and they oftentimes, it's a group of maybe five or six guys who are oftentimes drunk at the time of the raid, but they go on these nighttime stealth runs, rounding up pigeons directly from people's home coops, taking them out to isolated spots along the Diamond Coast on the beach, and making a game of executing them there. And I actually rode along with a couple of these anti-pigeon militias and witnessed a lot of this. And so there's a pretty graphic scene of that occurring in the book itself.
And not only pigeons, but I mean, you've heard reports and tales of actual diamond smugglers going missing as well, disappearing.
Yeah. So again, though not officially sanctioned by De Beers, the security guards who labor for De Beers are just kind of allowed a lot of unspoken, unofficial leeway to enact the sorts of punishments that would greatly deter folks from smuggling diamonds. And so it was just kind of a what happens on the Diamond Coast stays on the Diamond Coast sort of mentality. And so a lot of these security guards got away with enacting pretty harsh physical punishments on people who were, even if they were just suspected of smuggling diamonds. There have been instances of just bodies turning up in the desert of folks who were executed after having been suspected of smuggling diamonds. And then there have been instances of folks just completely disappearing altogether. Yeah.
I'm amazed by the access that you were given. I mean, I'm impressed by the access you were given. It seems like it was almost like this is a story that has been ignored for so long or laying undisturbed that almost all sides, you know, the smugglers, the security, you know, the companies almost wanted this story to be told. I mean, as a journalist, as a writer, was this something that you felt, you didn't actually have to sort of write the book because it kind of came out of you and wrote itself?
Yeah, I was incredibly surprised that people were so eager to be so forthright with me about not only the atrocities they witnessed, but sometimes about the atrocities that they perpetuated. I remember sitting down with a former security guard, not Mr. Lester, but another guy named Nico, sitting down with him at a defunct golf club in Clancia, South Africa. And he was basically telling me that everybody is in part in on this ancillary industry of diamond smuggling at various levels. And so because everybody is kind of in on it, and because everybody sort of knows, it was the culture in the area that this was just kind of an open secret. And so according to Nico, he wasn't telling me anything that everybody in the area didn't already know. In fact, he told me that every single mayor in the history of Port Nolloth, South Africa, which is another small village on the Diamond Coast, every single mayor of that town had been arrested for diamond smuggling. So again, yeah, they saw it as this open secret that the rest of the world clearly didn't know.
How difficult was it for you to leave? I mean, I know you have to leave and write the book eventually, but when you've got somebody like Umsisi and you hear those human stories, I mean, without trying to sound too melodramatic, you must leave a part of yourself there and take a piece of that with you when you go.
Very much so. I it was difficult to leave. I was compelled to go back three times, and each time I went, I stayed longer than the time before. It's the sort of thing that really it gets its hooks into you, and you can't quite shake it, nor should I try to shake it. So yeah, it was difficult to leave. Unfortunately, I have no real way of contacting MCZ from afar. I would have to return to the area and look for him again, if indeed he is still there. Because now that De Beers has withdrawn some of their interests, a lot of folks who are laboring for the corporation, because they have downsized so greatly, have gone into exile in other parts of South Africa, looking for work. There are still diamonds to be mined in the area, but De Beers has actually made it illegal for the townsfolk to mine them themselves. Even though De Beers isn't actively doing it in the area, they still control the underground and underwater mineral rights and have banned the townspeople from going in and basically reclaiming the wealth that is embedded in their ancestral homeland.
What do you hope that people will take from the flight of the diamond smugglers?
I hope that it will serve as kind of an expose into the behind the scenes goings on and the human cost and the human toll enacted by the diamond industry. Of course, the human toll is widespread, but Flight of the Diamond Smugglers concentrates on one particular region and a few particular characters that serve as kind of a microcosm of more widespread corporate level of exploitation. And I hope people will think twice before giving their money to corporations like De Beers and look for a different way to express love for one another than ringing a diamond around your finger.
The book is called Flight of the Diamond Smugglers. It's by Matthew Gavin Frank. Matthew, if people want to find you online, is there a website? Do you have social media? Where can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so MatthewGFrank.com is my website, and I'm on social media as well. Just look for Matthew Gavin Frank.
The book is called Flight of the Diamond Smugglers. It's by Matthew Gavin Frank. Matthew, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Giles. Thank you.